What I find is that the entrepreneur did not know what they were getting into. They signed the contracts they did not understand. And I want to make sure that by listening to today's episode, you are going to be better prepared for those kinds of events so that you can tell good money from bad money.
Every big thing starts small. It's a natural law. Every big multinational corporation was once a small business. Welcome to the Small Starter Business Podcast, a unique podcast for practical tips and advice to help you start, grow, or turn around your business.
Welcome to another interesting episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. I am your host, as usual, John Paul Iwoha. Today's episode is about relationships with investors. And the title is really tricky clauses to watch out for in contracts with investors. Now, here's what I've noticed. Many entrepreneurs I meet, many of the entrepreneurs I work with, would always want to raise capital from time to time. It's either they need the money to start the business, or they need it to grow the business, take it to the next level, or they need it to turn around a business that's been performing poorly. So what I notice is entrepreneurs are always focused on the money. I need to raise money. I need to raise $100,000. I need to raise $500,000. I need to raise $1 million or more. That's what entrepreneurs are about, the money, because they need the money to take their, to realize their vision, to execute their strategy, to transform their idea into a real business. Now, investors on the other side, and by investors, I mean people who provide money as equity investments in businesses. Investors on the other side are focused on the contract. The contract is the legal document that defines the relationship between the entrepreneur and the investor. So I see this weird thing going on. Just imagine two people are across the table. The entrepreneur is focused on the money. They're just looking at the money, you know? But then the investor is looking at the contract. They're looking at the agreement. So the important thing here is the moment you accept money from somebody, that person becomes a new and important stakeholder in your business. And it's important that when you have a new stakeholder, it's important that you understand the rules and terms that are going to guide that new relationship, the relationship between you and that new stakeholder. And if you do not understand the terms, the clauses, the rules that go into the contract, you are going to be setting yourself up for potential conflict with that investor in the future. I'm sure you've heard in the media several different horror stories, entrepreneurs who are fired from their company, entrepreneurs who have been forced to sell their company, you know, and all sorts of things. All of these things have roots in the contract. You know, you don't just take somebody's money just like that. That person will want some guarantees. That person will want to make sure that their back is covered. And how they do that is in the contract. But then many entrepreneurs claim legal ignorance. Some of them say, I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand what these terms are. Your lawyer is going to have your back. If you've hired a lawyer or an attorney to look at your investment contract, but then the lawyer may not have the commercial sense that you as the entrepreneur would have, which is why it's important that even if you don't understand all the clauses, you need to understand the game that's going on. And the purpose of this episode of the podcast is to give you an entrepreneur's perspective on the way contracts are crafted. In fact, I'm not going to bore you with all the legalese and all the finer details. I'm just going to focus on the clauses that are the most tricky, the most important ones that you need to focus on so you can avoid trouble. You know, raising money from an investor should be an empowering event. It should be something that you look back on as a major milestone in your business. Although there are many entrepreneurs have raised money from investors without any problems. They've raised money and they've made money for everybody. The business grew and became very successful. The entrepreneurs made a healthy return on their investment. It was a win-win situation. Everybody's happy. But like I said, not all relationships turn out that way. Some of them end up in disputes, in conflicts, and at the root of it, what I find is that the entrepreneur did not know what they were getting into. They signed the contracts they did not understand. And I want to make sure that by listening to today's episode, you are going to be better prepared for those kinds of events so that you can tell good money from bad money. So let's get right to work. Now, the very first place to start, because I like to focus on strategy. I don't like to get into too many fine details that can overwhelm you with information. So I'm really just going to share with you what really matters. The very first place to start here is to let you know the three major factors at play in any relationship with an investor, in any contract you're going to sign. There are three major factors that are going to shape the language, the clauses, the terms, and the rules in that contract. It doesn't matter how much money you're trying to raise. It doesn't matter what kind of investor you're trying to raise, whether it's an individual investor or an institutional investor. These three factors are going to come to play. The very first factor is power. Every contract is built to protect people's interests. It could be your interests, it could be the investor's interests, it could be the interests of the both of you, but power is always at play. And when I say power, I mean control. Who controls the company? Who controls key aspects of the company? Who makes the key decisions? Key decisions about how much dividend is paid, how much to raise at the next financing round, what's a major business strategy the business should pursue. What kind of senior executives can be hired into the company? These are very, very major decisions. And the person who has power based on the contract can wield that power to protect their own interests. You know, so very important. Power is always a key factor in any contract. The second is risk. And by risk, I mean, how much do I lose if something goes wrong? Now, it's an investment. Investors know there is upside and there is a downside. Even though entrepreneurs always look on the bright side, there's always a chance that things may not turn out the way you expect. It could be because the market changed. It could be because of your competitors' actions. Anything could happen. It doesn't matter how bright your business idea is. It doesn't matter how bright the prospects of your business are. Things happen. Things can go wrong. And investors understand this. The business of investment is about understanding risk and reward. So when an investor is coming into a relationship with an entrepreneur and they have a contract that's about to be signed, the investor is asking himself or herself, if something goes wrong with this investment and this business does not succeed, how much do I lose? Now, investors want to make sure they lose as little as possible. And I'm going to explain to you how they do it and why. So, like I said, if you're an entrepreneur, it's very likely you're an optimist. And like I said, optimism is our biggest superpower as entrepreneurs. It's also our biggest weakness, because I've never seen an entrepreneur who believes their business will not work. I've never seen an entrepreneur who believes their business is not going to succeed. Still, businesses fail all the time. So it's in your best interest to look out for yourself, especially in the area of risk. If things don't go the way you expect, how much do you lose? And it's in your interest to protect yourself from significant downside. The third factor at play is return. And by return, I mean, how much do I gain? How much money do I make if things go well? Remember, investment is about risk and reward. Things can go wrong, but things can also go right. And sometimes they can go extremely right. So in that kind of situation, how do I maximize the returns I make from this investment? That's a question investors ask. And you should also be asking yourself that question as an entrepreneur. If your business becomes very successful, how much of that upside do you keep for yourself? So these are the three major factors at play. The first is power, the second is risk, and the third is return. So now that you understand the three major forces, the three major factors that shape any kind of contract you're going into, like I said, it doesn't matter how much money you're trying to raise or what kind of investor you're trying to raise this money from, they are going to be interested in these three major factors. And this is exactly what they are going to use the clauses, the terms, the conditions, the covenants in the contract to bring to life. So before I go ahead into the specific clauses I want to talk about, I want to make it very clear, I'm not a lawyer. But what I am is an accountant. What I am is somebody who works at different times, or either on the side of the investor or the side of the entrepreneur. I've been involved in several deals where I was on the investor side. So I had to protect the interest of the investor. And I saw a lot of mistakes on the entrepreneur side. But it's not the job of the investor to protect the entrepreneur's interest. Everybody has to protect their own interest. At the minimum, it needs to be a fair relationship. But many times I see how ill-equipped entrepreneurs are when they are coming to the table. You're dealing with an investor who is savvy, who understands legal implications, who understands legal clauses, and all you're looking at is the money. Meanwhile, there's a lot of things inside the contract you just don't understand. So, and you could be taken advantage of, unfortunately, if you don't know how to look out for yourself. I've also been on the entrepreneur side several different times. And I'm working with entrepreneurs who are just focused on the money, and they're like, you know, John Paul, just make sure I'm not being taken advantage of. And I see contracts, I see term sheets that investors send to entrepreneurs, and I see how they're trying to take advantage of these entrepreneurs. And then I have to kick back and protect the interests of my client. So as somebody who has been on the two sides, all I really want is a fair deal. I want a win-win. I want the investor to be happy, and I want the entrepreneur to be happy. I don't want anybody to lord it over the other person. So I'm going to try to be as fair as possible, as I usually am in some of the deals that I do. I even end up sometimes coaching the entrepreneurs we're trying to bring on board. And sometimes even their lawyers may not understand the commercial aspects of some of the clauses that are coming in. So I try my best to educate and inform them and let them understand why these clauses are there. We're not trying to take advantage of you. We're just trying to be fair. But like I said, that you're not a lawyer is not an excuse for not understanding what you're signing. You are the founder of the company, or a co-founder of the company. You are the CEO of the company. What that means is you're ultimately responsible for what happens. You cannot claim ignorance. You cannot say, I didn't know. Your signature is on the contract. So you need to understand exactly what you're walking into. So that said, let's walk directly into the specific parts of an investment contract, an agreement, whatever you call it, a shareholders agreement, a share purchase agreement, whatever name you call it. These are the documents that define the relationship between you and the investor. And these are the clauses you need to look out for. The very first is the clause that concerns the ownership stake. So how much equity does the investor actually get? The amount of equity, the ownership stake, by this I mean, is it 20% of your company? Is it 30%? Is it 60%? That would depend a lot on the valuation of your company. So if an investor is saying they want to give you $100,000, and you are presenting to them that your business is valued at $1 million, that's a pre-money valuation of $1 million. What it means is that the investor is going to take 10% of your company. By giving you $100,000 in a $1 million company, they own 10%, right? That's how it works. One thing an investor will do is they will try to negotiate down the valuation of your company. For example, they are going to say, you're a new company, you just started, you don't really have a lot of revenues, you haven't really made a lot of money, you only have one customer or just a few customers, you're very vulnerable, you have very big competitors, they could crush you, you know. So all these things they are saying is they are trying to negotiate down your valuation. And the reason they're trying to negotiate down your valuation is the lower your valuation, the higher the equity they have in your business. Now, none of the things the investor is saying is wrong. All the things they're saying are factual market information. But again, remember, it's a negotiation. So you need to counter their arguments. You need to show why you are worth the valuation you say you are worth. And if you cannot defend yourself, or if you're too focused on the money, what happens is that the investor has their way, and maybe an investor that ordinarily should have 10% of your company ends up owning 15% or 20% or 20 or 25% because you are inexperienced, because you don't know how to ask for what is yours. So it's very important, that ownership stake part. The percentage the investor gets depends on your valuation. And there is no particular formula for calculating the valuation of a company. It is subjective. The value of a company lies in the eyes of the beholder. So because it's subjective, it can be negotiated. But what I see is that entrepreneurs do not do a good job of defending their valuation. Remember, the higher your valuation, the better for you, the entrepreneur. The lower your valuation, the better for the investor. So I'm not saying you should put an outrageous valuation on the table. All I'm saying is that you put a valuation on the table that you can honestly and reasonably and logically defend. So the ownership stake part is a major clause to look out for in any investor agreement. The second clause to look out for is the type of shares. So it's granted this investor is going to have 20% in your company. But then there are different kinds of equity shares. When somebody owns equity in your company, it's not as simple as saying they just own 20%. 20% of what? Usually there are two major types of shares. There are common shares, also known as ordinary shares, and there are preference shares, also known as preferred shares. Now, the kind of shares the investor gets in your company can significantly change the game in terms of what they can get and what they can do. And remember the three factors: power, risk, and return. The kind of shares an investor has in your company will determine how much power they wield in your company, how much risk they can bear, and how much return they can get from that investment. So let me just focus on the preferred and preference shares, because that is usually the kind of shares that investors like. And that's because it comes with several different rights that really favor the investor. Left to an investor, most of them will prefer taking on preferred shares or preference shares over ordinary shares or common shares. And like I said, preferred shares come with certain rights that ordinary shares will not get. I'm going to mention some of these rights in this episode so that you see how they differ from ordinary shares. Preferred shares have higher seniority than ordinary shares. When it comes time to pay dividends, preferred shareholders get paid first before ordinary shareholders. If the company is crashing and is liquidating, and the company is, of course, going to be shut down, when people start to get compensated, preferred shareholders get compensated first before ordinary shareholders. Preferred shares are a senior type of shares to ordinary shares. And you can imagine what this means for risk. What this means is that if things go bad and the company is shutting down, what it means is that the preferred shareholders will be compensated first before the ordinary shareholders. That means their risk is lower. Another thing too about preferred shares, something called cumulative interest. I forgot to mention, for preferred shares, the dividend that is paid to them sometimes is mandatory. You have to pay them dividends for preferred shares. For ordinary shares, they only get a dividend if the company agrees to pay a dividend. Preferred shares can also convert into ordinary shares. There are things that happen in your company, and I'll give you a specific example. You raise money from an investor. Maybe let's say you raise $200,000 from an investor, and they want preferred shares in your company. Now, they know that in the future, if your business does really well, more investors will want to bring in their money. And at that time, maybe this investor, the earlier investor will want to exit or will want to cash out of your company. So what happens at that point is that the preferred shareholders will want to convert their preferred shares into ordinary shares. If they see that it's going to maximize the return that they can get, they will put it in there in the contract to say that at a point in the future, based on certain triggers, and they may specify some of these triggers, one of which could be your ability to raise more money in the future. If such a thing happens, then the preferred shareholder may have the right, may have the prerogative to convert their preferred shares into ordinary shares. And sometimes they define a ratio. It can be one preferred share to two ordinary shares, or one preferred share to three ordinary shares, or one preferred share to even 10 ordinary shares. It all depends on what the investor can get away with. And it's your job as the entrepreneur to say, you know, it should not be one preferred share to five ordinary shares. It should be one preferred share to one ordinary share. You can negotiate these things. But like I said, it's not the investor's job to protect your interests as an entrepreneur. You as the entrepreneur need to protect your own interest. But you cannot protect your interest if you don't know what those interests are. And that's why I'm telling you these things. You know, the conversion ratio, very important. Now, remember what I said about mandatory payment of dividend to preferred shareholders. Now, there are actually two types. There's the cumulative and non-cumulative. And I'm going to explain what this thing, what it means. Preferred shareholders want to reduce the risk of investing in your business. So what they say is that every year, you are supposed to pay them a specific percentage of your profits, or you're supposed to pay them a specific return on their investments as dividends. It's mandatory in some sense. But when an investor says their dividends have to be cumulative, what it means is even if you don't make profits this year, you know, and you don't pay them the dividend this year, that dividend will roll over. The dividend you are supposed to pay them will roll over into next year. And if you can't pay them next year, it will roll over into the next year. And what you see is after 5 years, you're not just owing the investor's investment. You're also owing a backlog of dividends. And that's because they have cumulative preference shares. Their interest in your company, their dividends that they are entitled to accumulate over time. So these are just some examples of the unique rights that preferred shareholders have over ordinary shareholders. And now sometimes people will ask, entrepreneurs will ask me and say, why would any entrepreneur in his right mind allow an investor to have preferred shares? It's a very reasonable question, but this is how it happens. When an investor is taking a risk in your business, especially early on where you're trying to raise money from different people and you're getting turned down. A lot of people don't believe enough in your business to give you their money. You're just getting stories and all sorts. So in that kind of situation, when you find that investor who is willing to give you money, what happens is that more or less you allow them to get a you allow them to get away with quite a bit because they're willing to give you their money. So that's exactly how it happens. When you have a lot of investors who are interested in investing in your business, you have the opportunity to call the shot. But when in the early days of your business, you're still struggling to get investors to give you money, it's going to be really, really difficult for you to tell them that they can't do this or they can't do that. They have the advantage at that point because they are one of the few people who are willing to give you money. So there's nothing wrong with allowing investors to have preferred or preference shares in your company. You just need to understand the kind of rights that are attached to those preference shares and make sure that they don't go overboard. The third important clause I want to talk about is anti-dilution protection. And now what anti-dilution protection means is that, in fact, it's actually a mechanism that investors use to reduce the risk that their investments would be devalued when they invest in your company. So here's what I mean. An investor gives you money, let's say $100,000, and your business is valued at $1 million pre-money valuation. What that means is that the investor has 10% in your company, which is valued at $100,000. 2 years down the road, you decide to raise money and you're raising an additional, let's say $3 million, right? Bottom line is by that valuation, you're going to issue some new shares and all of that. Maybe the investor might end up with say 5% of your company, but how much is that 5% worth? If that 5% of a company that's now worth $3 million, that's around $150,000. That means the investor's investment is growing, right? Now, in the event that you're about to raise money in the future and the value of your equity is lower in your company, then that investor would have to be protected by anti-dilution. What anti-dilution means is that after the investor puts money in your business and you're trying to raise money in the future, the investor's investment cannot be devalued below the amount they initially invested in your business. It could be the equity stake, the percentage, or the actual value of their investments in your company. So that is one way investors protect themselves from the downside. If the value of your company is growing, if the valuation of your company is growing, it doesn't matter as long as the investor's money is growing along with a higher valuation. But if the valuation of your company is dropping, the anti-dilution protection makes sure that the investor's investment in your company is not diluted below the amount they invested in your company. I hope that as much is clear. And when you really look at this, even as an entrepreneur, you see that it is fair You know, this investor is taking a risk in your business. At the minimum, they shouldn't lose their money, you know, and that's what anti-dilution is in there for. So it's one of those things where you really don't want to argue, because if you are a fair person, you see exactly what the investor is trying to do here. They're trying to protect themselves from the downside. And now the very next clause I want to talk about is the clause called liquidation preference, participation rights. The participation rights that come with the liquidation preference. So let me break this down, liquidation preference. What it means is, if there is a liquidation event, and a liquidation event usually could be other investors, new investors bringing in more money after the initial investor has brought in money. That's a liquidation event. And what it means is that when new investors bring in money into your company, it's an opportunity for the old investors to exit, to cash out, because those new investors are going to buy shares in the company. So the older investors can sell their shares, either part of their shares or all of their shares, to the incoming shareholders. And that way they make money. So because what it means is that they've come into your company at a certain time in the past, and right now your company has attracted new investors who are coming in to buy shares. I can sell my shares to them and then I exit. That's what a liquidation is called, a liquidation event. Or it could be that the company is getting listed on the stock exchange, is doing its initial public offering, the IPO. That's also a liquidation event. Or it could be that another company is trying to buy out your company. These are not just investors. A bigger company, maybe one of your bigger competitors, is trying to buy the entire company. That's a liquidation event, because big money is coming in. So that's an opportunity for people inside to cash out. So that's what liquidation means. Liquidation preference means, when new money comes in, who has the rights, who has the seniority to take money first? And that's where that thing I told you about preferred shares comes in. Preferred shares have a seniority over ordinary shareholders. So because they are senior, when new money comes in, the preferred shareholders eat first. They take money first before the rest is shared with the ordinary shareholders. But let me break it down. It's not unfair. Let me break this down. There are two types of liquidation preference when it comes to preference shareholders, for people who own preferred shares. There are participation rights, full participation, and non-participation. Now, even when it comes to full participation, for example, there could be 1x participation. Don't worry, just hang on there. I'm going to explain this. Let's imagine that an investor that gave you money, $100,000, for 10% of your company, has now been with your company for 2 years, and now all of a sudden your company is being bought by a bigger competitor for $10 million, right? So this guy owns 10% of your company, and now your company is being bought, which is a liquidation event, for $10 million. Now, ordinarily, you could say that because he owns 10% of the company, his share of the 10 million would be 1 million, because 10% of 10 million is 1 million, right? But that's not how participation works, especially full participation. So what happens is, if the investor is asking for full participation right, and it's going to take his own share at 1x, what 1x means is that the initial $100,000 they invested in your business, they are going to take out that money first from the $10 million. So you see what's happening here. Before any money is shared, the preferred shareholder takes out their initial investment of $100,000 from the $10 million that's coming in. So what is left is $9.9 million. And then from that $9.9 million, the investor gets 10% of the $9.9 million, which is supposed to be $990,000. So when you add $990,000, that's $9.9 million. 10% is $990,000. When you add $990,000 to the $100,000 the investor has taken out, that's over $1 million. This can actually really ratchet up if the amount that is involved is a lot. But what this means is that because it's 10 million, it could also be 1 million, meaning that the company is sold below the initial worth. Also, imagine what happens if, rather than being bought for 10 million, the company is being bought for $500,000. So that means the company has been devalued below what the investor actually came in at. That's when you start to see the power of liquidation preference. Because yes, when it's $10 million, everybody makes money. But what if it's $500,000? What it means is that from that $500,000, the preferred shareholder takes out their initial $100,000 before anybody gets anything. And then out of the $400,000 remaining, they take their own 10%. So you see that when the valuation is lower, liquidation preference with participation rights helps the investor to limit their loss in that kind of situation. So that is one way of managing risk. That is one way the investors manage their risk. So that's the way it works. If you see liquidation preference, they are talking about who gets what first when money comes in. If you see participation rights, it shows you how the preferred shareholder is going to participate in the money that will be shared. If it is non-participation rights, what happens is that the preferred shareholder only takes back what they initially invested. But sometimes, if that is the case, it's going to be 2 times or 3 times or even 10 times their original investment. Bottom line is, this is a risk management mechanism for investors. The fifth, for those of us who don't know, a properly organized company has a board of directors. The board of directors is responsible for making major decisions about the company, mainly strategic decisions. The managers and the people who run the company can make the day-to-day decisions. But when it comes to strategic decisions, like should we sell the company? Should we raise more money? Should we hire a new CEO or CFO? Should we fire the existing CEO, which could be you? These are the people who decide it. And when matters come to a head, they have to vote. Usually, an investor will ask for seats on your board. They could ask for, and it depends on how much money they are bringing into your company. The more money they bring in, the more power they want to project and wield on your board. They could ask for 1 seat on your board. They could ask for 2 seats or 3 seats, depending on the amount of money that they are bringing in and their stake. The higher the stake they have in your company, the more power they will want to project. So, but where things come in, this is now the political side, because it's about power. This is now the political side you need to understand. An investor can ask for 2 seats on your board. It's not a problem if the total number of seats you have on your board is 8 or 9. What it means is that no single vote of theirs can knock you out, right? But if they have 1 seat on your board and all you have are 3 seats or even just 2 seats on your board, or that's the total number of seats on your board, then that means their percentage is higher. So that's what you really need to look at. Yet, normally, preferred shareholders cannot vote because of the kind of rights that they have. And it's the ordinary shareholders who have the power to vote. But like I said, in an investment contract, if you don't know what you're looking for, an investor could, you know, more or less give themselves the right to be able to vote on an as converted basis, as if they were, you know, ordinary shareholders. The voting rights can actually be possible. Nothing says that preferred shareholders cannot vote. It depends on the agreement you have with them there. So when you give, like I said, giving an investor a seat on your board is reasonable. They've given you money. They need to be part of the major decisions of the company. It makes a lot of sense. But then you need to be sure that you have the political advantage on your side, because what that means is, if you have a board where you don't have the majority, and it can happen from time to time, there are many big companies, many startups that, you know, where the founder doesn't have majority on the board, it's fine as long as you're doing your job. But when those times come when a decision has to be made, maybe the company is performing below its potential and all that, if you don't have the majority on your board, that's what leads to you getting fired. You could be voted off your seat as a CEO of the company. Nobody can vote you out of your shares in the company, but you can be voted out of your executive position and responsibility as a CEO, CFO, COO. You see? So that's how it comes in. The voting, very important. There can be voting on very serious issues, who can be hired, who can be fired, and all that. So you need to keep an eye on board seats, because that is the place in the contract where the most power is usually concentrated. It determines who can make what decisions, who controls what in the company, and all other sorts of things. Okay, so another clause I want to talk about is the ability to force a sale or liquidity event. I've been on the investor side in a couple of deals, and there's a clause we put in there to say, if in the next 5 to 7 years, the company has not raised a particular amount of money or a lot of money, the investor has the right to force a sale. So what it means is that Every investor who comes in, most investors who come into your company want to get their money back. They don't want to invest in your company and just earn a dividend for life. Some of them want to put in money in your company. Maybe they put in $100,000. After 5 years, maybe that money grows to $500,000 or $300,000 or even $1 million. But the bottom line is every investor has a window. I'm going to give you this money for 3 years or 5 years, and then I'm going to take out the money. But how do they take out their money? So what they do with this clause is that if you are not able to raise money, additional money from new investors, which gives the old investors an opportunity to take all of their money out or part of their money out. What this clause does for them is that if after 5 years or 7 years, you've not raised more money or there's no liquidity events, you've not done your IPO on the stock market, you're not being acquired by any big company, they can force a sale. They can actually go out there and try to sell the company. And based on other clauses like drag along rights, like co-sale rights and all that, you are obligated to also sell to the new buyers. So this can be very restrictive. A lot of entrepreneurs don't know that these things are in there, but they are there. The investor will give you a reasonable time frame, 5 years, 7 years. If the company does not provide liquidation events, like new investors coming in with new money so that old investors can cash out, then the old investors can force the company to sell part of their shares or all of the company to new buyers. So this is very important to keep in mind. This is not entirely a bad thing. It can be good when you look at it in certain ways. There are entrepreneurs who have already made up their mind that they are going to sell their company at some time. These are venture thinking entrepreneurs. They are trying to build their business into an asset that can be sold at a high price so that they can retire, cash out, and do other things. There are entrepreneurs like that. But there are also entrepreneurs who are lifestyle entrepreneurs or legacy entrepreneurs. These are entrepreneurs who see their business as something they are going to do for life and maybe pass on to their children when they are no longer around. If you are a lifestyle entrepreneur or you are a legacy entrepreneur, this kind of clause does not favor you. Because what he says is, at a point in the future, the investor will force you to sell the company. But what if you don't want to sell the company? That's where there's a conflict. But if you're an investor that's already made up their mind that I'm building this business, I'm just going to give it 5 or 10 years of my life, and then I sell it, and then I retire. If that's how you're thinking, then it makes sense. It's a win-win. Because what the investor has done is, the investor has put you on your toes so that you work hard, build the business into a valuable asset that can be sold, that will make money for everybody. It's a win-win. So like I said, it's not good or bad. It depends on how aligned it is to what you want. If you are building it as a venture, fine. If you're thinking in terms of legacy or lifestyle, and you're thinking 20, 30 years, it doesn't make any sense. So you need to understand how this works. The next clause I want to talk about is due diligence cost. There's this thing called due diligence. You know, before you raise money, you go and pitch to the investor, present all these interesting PowerPoint slides, you talk them on, pitch them, sell them. Any investor who knows their salt is going to do due diligence. And due diligence means I want to really see the facts. Show me a copy of your audited account statements. Show me a copy of your bank statement so I can really see that the sales and revenues you say you are making are real, that the cash you say your company is making is real. I want to see evidence of it, real evidence. I want to meet with some of your customers. I want to see some of the contracts you have with your employees, with your partners, to make sure there are no legal exposures. All of all these things the investor will look at. And the more money the investor is investing in your company, the greater the due diligence that will happen. Due diligence will typically involve accountants, lawyers, financial consultants, all of that. Again, it depends on how much money the investor is bringing in. And because the investor has to hire all those professionals, due diligence can cost money. But who pays? So the way it works typically is that the due diligence cost will be part of the deal. And once the deal is closed, the company, your company, pays for the due diligence. Of course, out of the money you just raised. But it's supposed to be a reasonable amount, depending on how much the investor is bringing into the company. Some of the limits of the cost I've seen, for example, would be about, say, 1% of 1 to 2 to sometimes up to 5% of the overall deal value. Sometimes it can be low, as low as 0.5%. So what we're saying is that the due diligence cost should not go above, say, 1.5% of the amount, total amount of money the investor is bringing in. Once the deal is sealed, then the company pays for the due diligence cost from the money it has just raised. But then the question comes, and the investor is asking, what if after all these discussions and negotiations, and I do my due diligence, and I see something I don't like, and this deal does not happen? Who pays the accountants, the lawyers, and all these people who got involved? So there's usually something in the agreement that says that if the investment does not go ahead because of something the entrepreneur has said or not said, or done or not done, essentially, if it's the fault of the entrepreneur that the deal cannot go on, then the entrepreneur must pay the due diligence costs, you know, so that the investor's risk is limited. And this is very sensible. If I'm willing to invest in your company and I find something that you didn't tell me before or you lied to me about, and as a result, I can't go ahead to invest in your company, all the people I've hired, all the professionals I've hired to help me do the due diligence, you will pay them. You, the entrepreneur, will pay them. It's fair enough. So that way, you are not going to willingly waste my time because you think, you know, there's no cost to you. So that is one way to that you need to look at these things. So let's round. I don't want this episode to be really long. The next clause I want to talk about is the dispute resolution. In every relationship, there is a probability that there will be disputes or conflicts where people do not agree, up to a point where you want a divorce, as it were, in the relationship between the investor and the entrepreneur. So in those kind of situations, what happens? Do you go to court? Do you go through arbitration? Do you mutually appoint somebody to be the arbiter on the matter and decide? And if the person decides, will the two of you accept that judgment, as it were? Or will you only go to court? If you're going to court, in which country? Now, the justice systems in different countries are different. In some countries, the justice system is slow and corrupt. In some other countries, the justice system is trusted. So the investor will want the jurisdiction for the dispute resolution and the governing law of the contract to be in a country or a jurisdiction that they trust. So it's not uncommon for me when I do deals between investors and entrepreneurs who are based in emerging markets like Africa or even South America, for them to put the jurisdiction as the laws of England and Wales, or the laws of the United States, or the laws of Canada. It all depends on where the investor is coming from and if they trust the justice system of their own locality. That is what would determine what they put in there. So that's really straightforward. What the investor is saying is that if something goes wrong, they want to be able to have recourse to a competent court of law that will give them fairness and justice. That's exactly what they mean here. So at this point in the episode, let's recap. So I started this episode by talking to you about the three major factors at play when it comes to contracts and agreements with investors. The three major factors at play are power: who controls what, who decides what; risk: how much does the investor lose if something goes wrong; and return: how much does the investor make if the whole thing goes well? If the investor is asking himself or herself these questions, you too, as the entrepreneur, you need to be asking yourself these questions, because what you want is a win-win relationship. But again, like I said, it's not the investor's job to protect your interests as the entrepreneur. You, the entrepreneur, need to know how to protect your interests and actually do it. But then before you can protect your interests, you actually even need to know what they are, which is why I thought it's a good idea to bring up this episode and discuss some of these very important points. So and then, of course, after that, I went through 8 specific important clauses that you definitely have to look at before you sign any agreement with any investor. These are the clauses where power is likely concentrated. These are the clauses where the investor is likely limiting their risk. And these are the clauses where the investor is likely maximizing their returns. You cannot claim ignorance that you're not a lawyer. You have commercial sense. You're a business person. You're an entrepreneur. You should be able to know where your interests are being covered and where they are not. And I'm hoping that with this episode, you understand quite a bit of what this is. So at this point in the episode, I need to consider four things. The very first is to join the Insiders program. Now, I cannot tell you how one decision can make or break your business. Now, when it comes to closing deals, this is one of those parts where you need insights from somebody who's experienced. There are people who have been burnt in these deals before. They've either lost their company, or they lost their seat in the company, or they gave away more equity than they should have, or they gave away much more rights than they should have because they didn't know. And you know, it's not enough to just go to Google and Google all these things. You need to have practical understanding and application of it. And that is the benefit the insiders get. The insiders are the people who work directly with me to build and grow their business. And I am there to help them solve problems just like this. So as part of the insiders program, when they are going through due diligence, they're discussing with investors, I'm in their corner. They get my advice. I tell them what to do, what not to do, what to look out for, what to leave, what to push. These things are very important. You try to figure them out on your own, you may make a mistake. And like I said, your lawyer may not entirely be able to save you here because of the commercial sides of your of these agreements. You need commercial sense that is practical. The lawyer's job is to protect you legally. As long as the whole thing is legal, fine. But it depends on the level of commercial expertise that the lawyer has. So the person who should provide that commercial expertise is you. You should be able to tell your lawyer, you know, what if this happens? This is what I want. It's your company. You should be able to think strategically with all this information. And that is the benefits you get as an insider. By being a member of the Insiders, you have access to the dedicated courses that are already inside of our course area. For example, we have a dedicated course on Legal 101. Most of these clauses I have just explained to you are in there, plus more. And I break them down with specific examples so you understand what these things are, no matter in what language they are written. You would clearly understand that, oh, okay, this has the trappings of participation rights, or this is a drag along, or okay, this is what this investor is trying to do here, or maybe the investor is trying to dilute my board. You are able to think on your own without somebody hand-holding you. So that's what the insiders are. We are breeding a community of thinkers, business leaders, who understand how to protect their own interests and get a win-win relationship with entrepreneurs, so with investors. So whether you're trying to value your company and you're trying to set a valuation that makes sense, you're going to find the training in there. You also have my advice. You also have the benefit of the ideas and the experiences of other members of the Insiders program who have done what you're about to do, who have gone through some bad experiences, who have made some terrible mistakes, and you can learn from those experiences. So to learn more about the Insiders community and how you can join us, head over to smallstarter.com/insiders. Again, it is smallstarter.com/insiders. The second thing I want you to do is to tell your friends about this podcast. The lesson you have just learned in this episode is one of those things that entrepreneurs should ordinarily know, but the opportunity to learn these things are not very common. This podcast is free. The knowledge I share here is free. If you've learned this and you found value in today's episode, the only thing I ask of you, I'm not asking you to pay anything. The only thing I ask of you is to tell other smart people about this. The more smart entrepreneurs we have, the better quality of businesses we build, and the more healthy these businesses are. Because I know how it can feel when you started a company and then you raise money from an investor and you got a bad deal. So all of a sudden you're feeling like an employee instead of a founder of a business. The way you work at the business will change. Your vision for the business will change because an employee thinks very differently from an entrepreneur. So I want you to have a stake in your business that makes you feel like the entrepreneur that you are. It's going to improve the quality of the business you build. It's going to create more jobs. It's going to create wealth for our society. And it's going to help us prosper. So the more smart entrepreneurs we have, the better for us. So, and the role you have to play in making that happen is share this podcast. Share the Small Startup Business podcast with your smart friends. Forward this episode to them. Let them listen and more or less enrich their experience as they build their businesses. And then, of course, the third thing I want you to consider is to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a 5-star review. If you're listening to this on Apple, it's very easy to leave on Apple Podcasts. It's very easy to leave a review. The reason we're asking for a 5-star review is, besides the benefits to my ego, a 5-star review makes it easier for other people to find the podcast. And the more people who find this podcast, the more people who get this level of high quality business education that we desperately need to build our society, especially here in Africa. So to leave us a 5-star review, you can check us out at smallstarter.com/review. And then the very last point, join the Insiders program. There's no point for trial and error. The amount it costs you in a month to benefit from all the information from the experience of being an insider is far less than what you spend on what? Internet or entertainment and all of that. So it's important that you roll with a community where you can grow. And we're thinking long term. We're really thinking long term. So there are different problems you're going to face as you build your business. There are split-second decisions that can make or break your business. And in those times, you need to have access to somebody who can provide you the insights and the support that can help you carry the day. So to join the Insiders program, you can check us out at smallstarter.com/insiders. I wish you a great day. I hope you stay safe. And like I said, entrepreneurship is about learning, and we learn every day. And today you've just learned something about how to protect your interests when you walk into a deal with investors. I don't want you to have the upper hand. I also don't want the investor to have the upper hand. What I want is a win-win relationship that creates value for you, the entrepreneur, and for the investor. Because both parties, we need ourselves to build a strong and prosperous business community. Thank you, and talk to you in the next episode. Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. To take our free business courses or join one of our signature programs for special entrepreneurs like you, head over to smallstarter.com to join our private community. See you inside.